Okay. Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week we speak to Ian, who's homeless and living in his car here in Bristol, as well as all the other regulars. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Ian, who's come into the studio very kindly here to the City Academy, the Beacon Centre, where BCFM is based, to talk about the situation he's found himself in as homeless and living in his car. Hi, Ian. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi, thank you. Nice to have me. I hope I can help some people in the same situation that I've found myself in.
Well, tell us how you wound up homeless, because you're very articulate. You're a very, actually, well-educated chap. How on earth did you find yourself with no job and living in your car?
Basically, due to the reason I'm out of work is due to the bullying and other things that went on my last job. I decided to quit for my own mental health, and at the same time my mum's health was deteriorating. So basically I ended up quitting my job and being my mum's carer for the last 3 years of her life.
So you're in a situation, aren't you, if you quit voluntarily, that it's quite difficult to get benefits straight away, isn't it?
No, the situation was, because of the situation in the security industry, then I was able to sign on straight away. The jobs, you know, the job centre took my side of why I quit, and then they contacted my company and they said, well, all we know is he quit for reasons unbeknown to us.
Okay, so what job were you doing? What security?
I was doing security.
Okay, and how did you find that as a job generally?
I've been doing security for 25 years. I like the job, I like the industry, I like the sites that I was working on, and it was just unfortunate that certain guards decided that I was the odd one out, and they decided to make my life a living misery.
Okay, so tell us about that bullying. Were people bullying? What were they doing?
They were undermining my confidence. They were saying nasty things about me, untruths about me. Also, my travel interests didn't sort of fit in with traveling the world photographing aeroplanes. It was Ramstein in 1988.
Right, that's an American base in Germany, isn't
it? Yeah. Four Italian Air Force jets collided. One crashed into a beer tent and killed 88 people on the ground, women,
children.
So is this
an air show or something?
Yeah, it's an air show. Okay. A bit like the Shoreham Air crash a few weeks ago and the Nat that crashed at Chris Evans's do at Alton Park. Even this weekend, the Lars Vulcan bomber was doing a display and his nose wheel gear could not retract, and so it had to land at Prestwick with unsafe undercarriage. It was checked over at Prestwick and the undercarriage was locked down, and then on Sunday afternoon it flew from Prestwick back to its base at Finningley in Yorkshire, made a safe landing, and it's currently in the hangar at Doncaster.
Well, I suppose we should say it's lucky that the undercarriage was locked down and not locked up.
Yes.
Because otherwise that would have been quite nasty. Trying to land a Vulcan with no front wheels would be quite a hairy experience.
They landed a couple when they were in service and they are no longer flying. And in fact, the professionalism of British pilots can be seen yesterday when the British Airways 777 blew an engine on attempted takeoff in Las Vegas. None of the passengers was killed, injured. Okay, the aircraft is badly damaged due to fire, but, you know.
So in your security job, you just felt that someone had decided your face didn't fit?
Yeah.
And so you just walked out?
I just walked out. I'd had enough.
What was the straw that broke the camel's back then?
I you can't specify one particular day. It was just a build up of constant being undermined and having my abilities to question, you know, my face just didn't fit. So I decided.
But there are lots of different companies in the security world. Couldn't you just walk into another job? Was that easy or not?
I've tried. Yeah. I've been out of work for over 4.5 years. And okay, for the first 3 years I was out of work, I was basically a carer looking after my mum, who sadly passed away last year. And so, you know, for the first 3 years, I was basically looking after her.
Well, that's amazing, Ian, because you're not actually 100% fit yourself, are you?
No. I'm type 2 diabetic. I've got a severe leg problem, which has to be monitored by my doctor and my diabetic nurse on a regular basis. So it's a case now of wait and see what happens.
Well, look, how have you coped with being on Job Seekers? Now, it sounds to me like you should be on something else, not Job Seekers, if you're actually physically disabled, effectively.
At the moment, I can get around on 2 legs. Time will tell, see what happens with the second leg, you know, but at the moment, I am fit for work.
How have you been finding signing on? Because, I mean, actually being homeless and having to sign on is not an easy thing, surely.
Just turn up at the job centre twice a month, sign your life away, you know, prove to the job centre that you're doing your, you know, you're actually seeking employment. And then you sign to say you've been done no work for that now last 2 weeks, and then they just get JSA the following week.
What about becoming homeless, though? Because where were you when you became homeless?
Living in a park home in Stoke Gifford.
Right. And so why did they decide that you couldn't stay there?
Terms and conditions of my mum's will, the property had to be sold and the money divided between me, my brother and my sister.
So from that money, could you not rent somewhere else?
I've tried. This is the problem. Private landlords seem to pick and choose who they want to rent their rooms to. Letting agents seem to do the same sort of thing as private landlords. They discriminate against unemployed people. So even though I have got some savings, because I'm out of work... And also, it's the buy-to-let community. Apparently, there's some cause in the insurance policy that they can't rent to the unemployed.
Well, this is all a bit strange, isn't it? How many times have you actually tried to rent somewhere and found, they're not interested?
500 times since...
Good God, Ian, that's amazing.
Since February.
So you've got the money, you're quite happy to put down a deposit and pay your first month, second month's rent...
Yeah.
And yet no one will rent a property to you?
No. And some of the places I've actually looked at, you couldn't swing a cat in there. And yet they're advertising it as a 5-star luxury accommodation. Some of the landlords even want you to pay for a credit check. So if you pay, like, you give the landlord 120 quid, they do a credit check on you. You fail the credit check. Not only have you won't get the apartment, you also lose £120 of your own money paying for a credit check.
What can be done about this? It doesn't. I mean, you're absolutely at the cutting edge of this. What do you think can be done?
Well, I think there's been a law passed recently about landlords and letting agents. It's some kind of tax break for the landlords. We're waiting to see on that, but at the moment, you know, I've applied for 10 apartments today and not a single reply.
So how did you end up? I mean, was the car the only option?
Yes. It's either the sleeping in the car or it's sleeping on a park bench in Bristol. A lot of people think that homeless people you only see on park benches and in shop fronts. Since I've been homeless in the last 6 months, I've discovered that there's a lot of cars and vans and campers parked on Clifton Downs.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, up on the Downs.
Up on the Downs. Where the burger bar is in the daytime. There's a lot of cars and vehicles. You can even see cars and campers parked on side streets.
Now, I know I'm going back a couple of years now, but as you came in on the train from London into Bristol on the right-hand side, as you're on the way into Bath,
That's right. You should
be able to see a whole massive load of tents in the woods.
Yeah.
You've got exactly the same going on down in Wells. I was walking down there a few weeks ago, and in Wells, a load of people living in tents in the woods.
In fact, I know of one bloke, he worked as a permanent night shunter. He sleeps in his car.
What, the railways, you mean?
No, a lorry.
Oh, okay.
Works in he's a class one lorry driver. He works permanent nights and he sleeps in his car during the day. I had a Hungarian friend who spent a year sleeping in his car, working on minimum wage agency warehouse work. He returned to Hungary last week, stating that he doesn't see a future living in England because of the homeless situation.
Well, it's ironic, isn't it, that you've got this army of people queuing up at Calais to come into Britain, where people already here say they don't see a future.
Yeah, but why? Why do they want to? Not being funny, why does anybody want to come here? All us Brits, we want to leave. You know, I've got a brother who lives in Laos, a sister that lives in Australia, a cousin that lives in New Zealand. You know, people want to leave England and cannot understand why all these people want to come here. The only reason I can think that a lot of the people want to come here is because of our benefit system, which is wrong, because they haven't paid a single penny into this country, so why should they be allowed to come into England, get a council place, get all this money that
hang on, because there aren't any council places, are there?
I know.
Not anymore.
I know.
I mean, you know, I would have thought you, as a diabetic, someone who's very much homeless, having to live in your car, you would be one of the top number of people with points to get social housing of some sort.
No,
but there's just not.
According to the council, I'm not a high enough priority with their needs. So, apparently, a former caseworker of mine said to me last week, if I lose my leg, they'll find my leg a place to live, but I've got to stay in the car.
Even if you lose your leg?
If I lose my leg.
Is that really a prospect? I mean, I know diabetes, you can lose limbs, can't you?
The reason I've got to lose, I might lose my leg, is not due to diabetes, it's due to another health issue I've got. And because I can't get the proper rest in the night time, because I'm on my leg like 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So my leg is not getting the rest it needs. So, it's not getting. So it's cool. It's just the swelling is not getting a chance to rest.
So how have you managed to adapt to actually living in your car overnight? Have you got like a kitchen in there or something? Can you make a cup of tea in the car?
Nope. I have one cup of coffee a day. I have. I'm supposed to eat three times a day. I have a breakfast in the morning, I have an evening meal, late afternoon, early evening, and then I find somewhere to park up in somewhere safe that I know and trust, because after an incident on the Downs where some person tried to break into my car.
Oh, hang on, this is up. Because, I mean, you would have thought that if there's quite a few people sleeping in their cars up on the Downs, that would be everyone would be able to look after each other
a
little bit, no?
No, in fact, some of the people on the Downs actually threatened me because I was parked in their favourite spot.
Actually, so, in a way, because you're vulnerable as a homeless person, that you're actually being picked on?
Yeah.
Good
and, in
God.
Fact, 15 times in the last 5 months, I've had the police come round in the early hours of the morning and just literally sign a torch in my face and say, what are you doing?
Do you think the police get it, that there are people that just have nowhere to live?
The police don't understand anything. The police, you know, what did a Conservative MP call them once? Plebs and morons? That's my personal view of the police. I've got a friend who's having a few minor police problems. And I had a policeman come round to me one night, shinies talked into my face and said, "You need to change friends."
So, you know, that's interesting for someone who's come from the security industry to say that about the police. Isn't that just a kind of a little bit of infighting amongst different, you know, in a way there is the police is the state security thing and you are working for private security.
The police don't care. You know, I've suffered, you know, because of my aviation photography hobby, you know, during the 80s, you know, we'd go out for a day photographing and we'd get like 3 parking tickets in one day. So over the years, I've been used to the police treatment of minorities.
Well, are they almost treating you like a spy? Like you were spying on the planes, right?
Yeah.
Where did your hobby of taking photos of planes come from?
I don't know. My grandfather used to work for Westland Helicopters as a fireman, and during the Blitz in London, he was actually sent from Westland in Yeovil up to London to fight the fires. And so we put my interest in aircraft down to my grandfather.
What about getting a bath, getting a shower, getting a wash in?
Well, if I can't, what I do is I have a wash down every morning, and then 2 or 3 times a week I've got a friend in Bristol who will let me have a shower at their flat. So, and they also do my washing for me. And like I said earlier about the trouble with the police, I went down to have a shower one, and for some unknown reason, 2 police cars stopped me twice on the way down and twice on the way back.
Well, what were they stopping you for?
Banknote. That's one of the joys of motoring, apparently.
This is a bit bizarre, isn't it? That the police, it sounds to me as if they're harassing you for being homeless. Now, that's not what the police are there for.
Well, what are the police there for?
Well, they're supposed to be there to investigate crime, and you're not a criminal. So what are they doing stopping you?
I know an American... I said this to a policeman who woke me up the other morning and said, on American police cars, it says you're here to protect and serve. You lot is more like harass and bully.
Well.
And he said, well, I don't find that very funny. Yeah, I said, well, nor do I, being woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning by a torch and your size 12s.
I mean, is there any particular reason that they're saying, what are you doing here, since they actually know you're there and you know you're homeless?
In fact, the first 2 police officers, one was a PC and one was a PCSO, actually said to me, we know you're here, we know you've got your health issues, we can come round and check on you. But some officers see it's a way to harass and bully people.
What are the police... What are the police getting out of having a go at someone who's right on the edge like you are?
They're
I don't
bored.
Understand it.
I think a lot of it is they're just bored. They've got nothing better to do. You see, I think somebody was moaning about that. The Police Federation are always moaning how short of staff they are. Well, I was in a well-known burger chain recently. There was 8 of them sat in there having breakfast for 2 hours. Now, if they're not short of staff, how can they afford to spend 2 hours sat in the McDonald's? Sorry.
Well, look, I mean, quite clearly from what you're saying, there are some police out there who do understand this.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how, as a society, are we going to deal with this? We've got some people in our institutions that do understand that a homeless person is not to be bullied. They're actually a victim. And we've got others that don't. So
Most people think homeless people just live on park benches and sleep in shop fronts. They don't realise that there is a whole group of unemployed people. I know a doctor who lives in a tent. He's a member of a sports club. So he lives in a tent Monday to Friday. And if he wants a shower, he goes into his gym, has a shower. And that's how people do it. They live in their cars, they live in tents, they live in camper vans. And they shower in gyms or like in hospitals. So
it's amazing. The human spirit is so resilient, you know, that people will find a way to survive.
Yeah.
Even if they're evicted from their home.
Yeah. People, a lot of people I've come across since being homeless, don't realise that I'm homeless. You know, I've met people and they've made a derogatory comment about something I've done or said, and I've turned around and said, well, what do you expect after 6 months living in the car? You know, all my family have disowned me. You know, I've got a sister, a brother and sister who both live abroad. I've got relations in this country who said to my mum before she died, don't worry about him, we'll look after him. And since last January, I haven't heard one iota from them.
I mean, is it fear, do you think? That fear that people think, well, I don't want to end up like that, and to see you, it's almost like an example?
It's not a case of that. It is a case of people don't know how to treat me. You know, I've got some good friends who I've met over the last 30 years. We've been on trips to Europe and around the world together, and they treat me like I'm like them. One of my friends, I've got a feeling he's embarrassed to be seen with me because I am living in my car.
But you wouldn't necessarily know that if you met you in the street.
No.
So what's going on there?
Snobbery.
What about, because you are quite a knowledgeable, you're quite an articulate fella, Ian. What are your thoughts about the way that the city's going here, Bristol? You know, it's a city you know quite well, and with the Mayor Ferguson.
I don't agree with any of his transport policies. Why he wants to shut half of the city centre on a Sunday and cause traffic chaos, I'll never know. I think what Mayor Ferguson wants to be was a Boris Johnson type mayor.
Well, hang on, because Boris is a Tory.
Exactly. No. I mean the way that Boris... Not being funny, a lot of people, both Conservative, Labour, Liberal, Democrat, Independent, knocks the way that Boris does things. I think Boris Johnson is one of the most articulate, knowledgeable members of Parliament that we've got.
Well, that's interesting, Ian, because most people would expect if you've been... You know, you've been a sort of almost a victim of the system over the last 10, 15 years, the changes in the benefits and that sort of thing, that you would be more left-wing. But you're not. You're supporting the Tories.
I will do.
Why is that?
Because I can't vote Labour. My hatred of Labour goes back to 1966.
Crikey, that's a long way. Why 66?
Personal reasons.
So it's just a personal thing. But what... So, I mean, because... How do you square the whole Conservative thing, which is you've got to cope on your own, individualism, that kind of thing,
that's
with
what's
happened to you?
That's what the Conservative Party want, people who can think for themselves, not rely on the...
But you can think for yourself, can't you?
Yeah. The trouble with the Labour Party is they claim that they're the party of the working man. Look at the last Labour government. Look at all the stealth taxes we paid. What do we get to show for it? A bankrupt company that the Conservatives had inherited and what's happening nowadays is the cost of the last Labour government.
So who do you blame for the situation you're in? Obviously, you know, there should be some kind of safety net to catch people like you and make sure that you've got somewhere to live.
There's not, because the councils are up to their teeth sorting out problems, and a single white man on his own is not to them an important...
You haven't got enough points.
I haven't got enough brownie points. You know, I'm not a lesbian single mother who...
Your whole situation, can you see an end to it?
No. And it's going to get worse.
Do you think more people living in their cars? I mean,
more
you
people living homeless, yeah.
Is it an estate car that you're in or what? Yeah.
Yeah. Luckily, I was able to buy an estate car when my previous car died. So
what about something like a caravan? Surely even that's going to be better than in the car.
No.
Why?
Because a car is warmer than a caravan. My friend's son lives in a caravan in Pembrokeshire, and he said, I'd rather live in a car than in a caravan, because you've got gas heaters in a caravan, and you know, it's a personal choice. Some people would rather live in a caravan than a car. I'm quite happy at the moment living in a car.
Happy?
Content.
What about if you had the top job, you were Prime Minister, how would you change things to mean that people didn't have to live like that? Because this is really... I mean, we're the sixth richest country in the world. We shouldn't surely have people up on the downs having to sleep in their cars.
I'd prioritise on solving the UK's problems first and then other problems second. At the end of the day, we can invite 20,000 Syrians into the country, but all they're doing is they're putting more pressure on a struggling health service, a struggling education system. You know, the health service is in chaos because of the last Labour government. You know, the Labour people moan about this, that and the other that the Conservatives have cut. Why have they cut it? Because the last government made us bankrupt. As I said to a potential Labour MP in the last election, where did all the stealth tax money go? They can't answer the question. They don't know where it went because Gordon Brown and his cronies were too busy spending money on trivia items that we didn't really need.
Sounds to me like you might be able to get a job at Tory Central Office.
I don't think Conservatives would want me, to be honest.
No.
Because I'd be after David Cameron's job. and supporting Boris Johnson as the next Conservative leader. I think if the current Labour leadership goes the wrong way and Mr Corbyn's elected, thank God we won't get a Labour government for 10 years.
Well, look, Ian, it's been absolutely fascinating chatting with you. Thanks very much for bearing your soul. It's not the easiest thing to do when you're in the kind of situation where
you are. No, but I hope people who are homeless don't give up.
Have you ever felt like...
Yes. I actually drove up to where the Clifton Down Bridge is and I sat there and I thought, one of these nights I'm going to come up here, I'm going to walk to the middle of the bridge and I'm going to jump. Because I cannot see a future under Mayor Ferguson's leadership. I think Mayor Ferguson is doing more damage to the city of Bristol than he is good. I don't think an elected mayor is what Bristol needs. I think it works in London, it works in Manchester because of their bigger cities. I don't think Bristol needs an elected mayor like Mayor Ferguson. You know, I don't think Mayor Ferguson works.
What made you decide not to? What made you decide that I'm going to stick it out and carry on even though it's tough?
I got a phone call from a friend.
Well, thank God for that phone call, Ian, eh?
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks very much for, like I say, bearing your soul, coming in and telling us your story. Because some of us, I think, when we see people walking down the street, we just think, oh, well, they're just normal, like us. They've got somewhere to live. And, of course, there are actually increasing numbers now that have been evicted and that simply aren't. Finally, I'll just ask you, can you see a route at the moment to getting somewhere to live?
No. The more refugees we bring in, the more... people that come into this country that shouldn't be here, the homeless situation is just going to get worse and worse. I think the best thing in one way this country can do is vote to leave the EU in 2017, because I think that would stop a lot of them coming over. And the problem in Calais, if the French would get on and do what they're supposed to be doing, that wouldn't happen either. The French are the cause of all the problems at Calais. They wanted a Europe where you can get in, you can get off a boat in Italy and you can travel all the way to England unchallenged. The problem is, it's a European problem as soon as they did away with the border controls. Nobody loving the job. I need a house.
No, well, you never
I need a house. I need somewhere to live more than I need a job. I need a job, a house, a flat, somewhere to live before I can get a job. Most employees won't. Employers won't give me a job until I get a house.
That's a dilemma, isn't it? It's crazy.
You're being told
you've got to get a job, but you haven't even got anywhere to live. Bizarre.
And you can't get a flat because I haven't got a job.
Well, anyway, if anyone does want to give Ian a flat or help him or whatever with some work that he could get do contact us via the show. You can contact us via studio@bcfm.org.uk. And Ian, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined on the line now by, I know you as Nikki No Nukes, Nikki, down in Bridgwater. Are you still down in Bridgwater these days?
I am still down in Bridgwater, yes, Tony.
And you've been doing not just campaigning on Hinckley, because a lot of the battles on that seem to have been slowly but surely won over the last few years. What about the other end of the country, up at Faslane and the Trident nuclear deterrent?
Yeah, so... One of the things that I've been doing as well as campaigning against nuclear power is the other side of the coin, Tony, which is nuclear weapons. And in July, well, over the last 3 years, there's been a concerted campaign leading up to the election called Action AWE, Action Atomic Weapons Eradication. And as part of that, there's been a big focus on Burfield. I don't know if your listeners know what Burfield is, but in this country, we've got several places that are involved in the supply chain of nuclear weapons.
Mate, why don't you just take us right the way from the nuclear power stations, which produce, make the plutonium, up to Sellafield, where it's all reprocessed. And how does that find its way from originally being mined as uranium ore all the way to becoming a nuclear weapon? Take us through that little journey.
Okay, the first thing that happens is the uranium mining. Massively, massively environmentally hazardous process happens not in the UK, in countries such as Canada, the US, Australia, Namibia and Africa. Do you all remember, like, the big war? Well, I say the big war. There was a war in Mali quite recently. When I say a war, like, France and the UK used drones, I think, to bomb the hell out of Mali, and that was over uranium.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because they call them wars, these things. Well, actually, they're kind of a barrage by the West against poor little villagers with maybe an AK-47 or something. It's not really a war, is it?
No, not at all. Yeah, so they bombed Mali. And I know that Mali was talked about in the news, but I think what wasn't talked about was why, or the real reason why. And the real reason is the uranium. Mali has, I think it was under French control, like a French colony at some point, and they have access or want control of the uranium.
Well, I'd say it's deposit, under French control now, because there's French soldiers in there, aren't there?
Yeah, that's right. So the uranium is mined in other countries. It's a really, really hazardous process. The amount of rock you have to dig out in order to get the tiniest bit of uranium is massive. And so they leave behind these really big heaps called tailings. And most of the radioactivity, just as the ore is, most of the radioactivity is left behind in those tailings piles. No uranium mine in the world has ever been remediated by the companies that did the damage. In America, there's a big movement of indigenous people who try to remediate mines on their own lands. The indigenous people, and it usually is indigenous people, by the way, these people live with awful health effects and health problems from the tailings that they're left behind with. So, you know, we as British electricity consumers or weapon consumers have a responsibility in the degradation of these people's lands.
Well, that's also, I mean, the sorts of health problems that people have often is it genetic, isn't it? Because the radioactivity can affect people's ability to reproduce and actually destroy DNA. So you end up with all sorts of mutated kids, for God's sake.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, this goes to the heart of why nuclear, you know, why uranium mining is bad, is the same reason of why nuclear power is bad, is the same reason of why nuclear weapons are bad. Because, you see, and it's really hard for people to understand because, you know, I had a journalist say it to me yesterday, well, you know, more people have been killed by wind power than by nuclear power, which I had to laugh at. But on a more serious note, people, it's not about the killing. Like, in terms of the genetic problems, like, you could kill everyone in the city of Bristol tomorrow, which would be terrible, absolutely terrible, but it wouldn't affect the genetic viability of the human race. Now, if you killed them all with a nuclear bomb, then it does affect the viability. And this is the thing, these two issues don't get talked about very clearly very often. So that's one of the things that I wanted to say. So the uranium mining, so that happens. It gets mined, it gets milled, where they separate out. Well, what they want is uranium-235. 235 is what they call fissile, which means it reacts very well for them in a nuclear reaction. And they mine and mill the uranium. They process the uranium into a form of a powder called hex, uranium hexafluoride. That product gets shipped around the world, so that comes into our ports here in the UK. And I can't remember which way around it is. We have Capenhurst and Springfield in the UK, and one of them sorts out the hexafluoride and the other forms it into fuel rods. Those fuel rods are then transported around the country by rail and by road, and they are taken to the nuclear power stations around our coast, where they are burnt. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because the government would like you to think that there is no connection between the nuclear power and nuclear weapons, you know, that these are completely separate issues.
Well, you might actually say the Iranians would say the same, Nikki.
I'm not going to get into too much tonight about other countries' politics about the issue, because I really want to focus on the UK's role.
Sure.
And the role of our state. And so, you know, states, nuclear weapon states, well, any states, don't want you to think that there's much of a connection between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And we have the lovely farce of the IAEA, which is the International Atomic Energy Authority. People think it's a watchdog. It's not a watchdog. It has some roles about inspecting nuclear facilities. And it has a role to promote what it calls the peaceful use of nuclear power. The trouble is the infrastructure you can't separate, and what comes out of those reactors, plutonium and a whole cocktail of other radioisotopes, what comes out of those reactors is what goes into bombs, not to put too fine a point on it. Calderhall, the first nuclear power station that was ever opened in the UK by the Queen, they said it was for power. Even then, back in the 1950s, said the reactor was for nuclear power. 6 months later, it was admitted that it was for plutonium. Hinkley B, where I live, Hinkley B is a bomb factory. And I say that, now let's see if I can remember the chap's name, Ross Hesketh. He was a Quaker. Quakers are committed to peace. They don't want any jobs in the arms industry. Ross Hesketh was a Quaker who worked in what he thought was the civil nuclear power industry. When he found that plutonium from our stations, our B stations. So Calderhall, sorry, let me backtrack. Calderhall was an A station, the first generation of nuclear power stations. They were all Magnox reactors in this country, and they all produced plutonium. That's what they were built for, was to produce plutonium. The power is a byproduct of the plutonium and not the other way around. So then we had a next generation, which were the B stations. So Hinkley B, the whole Hinkley B was configured to produce plutonium. And Ross Hesketh, when he found out plutonium from our B stations was ending up in American warheads, being a Quaker, he couldn't have that on his conscience. And he exposed this and wrote a letter to the Times and lost his job over it. So historically, that's the link. Our government would say now that the generation of reactors it wants to build, they're not configured to produce plutonium. In fact, they want to put high burn-up fuel for them, which they would leave in for a very long time and would make some very, very nasty, nasty, if you can even say it's nastier than what we already make, even nastier waste that's even harder to manage and deal with. But the thing is with these reactors, they can be configured any way the operators want to configure them. We in the public have got very little way of knowing the configuration of any one reactor and the fuel rods in it at any one time. And they can leave one mod in. They could have 50 rods in there, leave 48 of them in there for 3 years, but take two out after 6 months. And 6 months is kind of about the optimum time, I think, when they want to have plutonium.
Now, so, I remember hearing that when the fuel rods come out of the reactor down at Hinkley, they have to sit for several years in a pond of water just to cool down, and then they go up to Sellafield. They get reprocessed. The plutonium is then taken out, which, as you say, is used, it's weapons-grade plutonium. Then it's used for bombs. Now, you've been involved recently, haven't you, in calling the government to account over Trident.
Let me just say something about plutonium, because this was a real shock to me when I discovered this, because what do you know about plutonium and how long it lasts, Tony?
It's heavy.
Okay, it lasts, well, the half-life of plutonium-239, which is what they tend to use in the big A-bombs, hydrogen bombs, or, you know, when they make the traditional bombs that they dropped in Japan, the half-life is 24,000 years. Now, everyone, the government talks about the plutonium stocks and all the plutonium we've got at Sellafield. So everybody thinks that we've got enough plutonium, that why would we ever need to make any more? And what I learned when I got involved with researching and learning for myself about these issues is, although it has a half-life of 24,000 years, it has a shelf life in terms of being usable in a nuclear weapon of just about 2 or 3 years. So contrary to popular belief in amongst us as lay people, where we think, oh, God, there's loads of plutonium, it lasts forever, why would you need any more? They actually have to keep making fresh plutonium, because after 2 or 3 years, enough of the plutonium has decayed that it's not going to perform properly if they drop that bomb. So they have to take the plutonium out of the bomb and replace it with new plutonium. So I want to explain why the government always have a reason for making more plutonium.
That's amazing. Anyway, look, let's get cut to the chase with your court case, Nikki.
Yeah, so last year, as part of, you know, concerted effort to really get Trident onto the agenda, we had lots of blockades at Burfield, which is where they make the triggers for the bombs, and they then load the bombs at Burfield and they take them all the way up the motorways on army trucks to Coalport, the bomb store, where they're then loaded onto the Trident submarines at Faslane, which is where Trident sits when they're not at sea. And what happened last summer was there was an escalating situation with Israel bombing Gaza, with Ukraine and planes being shot down, and the international tensions were escalating. The government rhetoric in this country has moved from saying that we'd only ever use nuclear weapons in a defensive situation to countless ministers in the last government and the previous government before that outlining first strike circumstances. In other words, they would use these weapons that can incinerate 15 million people in one go. They would use these as a first strike, just when they're not getting their own way politically, in a context which is absolutely immoral and is most definitely illegal. And we had concerns that what was escalating was a situation that might lead to a first strike. And we knew that HMS Vengeance was berthed at St. Leven's Dockyard in Plymouth.
So is that one of the Trident submarines?
Yeah, there's HMS Vengeance, Vanguard, Vigilance, and I can't remember the name. I can't remember the name of the other two, but Vengeance was in the dock. Now, the thing about making preparations to commit a war crime is if the act of launching a warhead itself couldn't be done legally, then the possession of the warhead, manufacture of the warhead, maintenance of the warhead, all of those things would also be illegal. And we were clear on this 20 years ago from the International Court of Justice advisory opinion that they produced in 1996. That, you know, these weapons, in the highest legal opinions in the world, you know, were more than likely illegal rather than legal. And they couldn't rule either way because it was an advisory opinion. So they didn't actually have an actual legal case in front of them. What they had was a question. And so it was very difficult for them to say, you know, definitively one way or another, because they weren't ruling in an actual case, if that makes any sense. So HMS Vengeance was berthed in Devonport Dockyard at St. Leven's Dock. There were about 3,000 or 4,000 people employed there by Babcock Marine. So they're quite a significant employer in Plymouth. And those poor people are unfortunately engaged in work that is a preparation for a war crime. And so having limited means, you know, available to us as ordinary people, I'm a mum, I have children, so there's limits to what I can do and there are moral limits to what I would do also. We did what we felt we could do, which is we went to the dockyard to disrupt the work, the maintenance and upgrading work. This work, by the way, would allow the UK government to extend its policy of deterrence, as it calls it, a continuous at-sea deterrent. And, you know, we're signatories to a treaty called the Non-Proliferation Treaty. We signed that treaty in 1962. So we've had over 53 years to disarm.
So and what, that so, treaty... So what happened when you came to court, Nikki?
So what happens when we went to court is we went to court yesterday. I've been on bail for over a year. And we went to court yesterday and my co-defendant, Theo Simon, had to represent himself. I had a fabulous barrister by the name of Tom Wainwright, who I think he represented Caroline Lucas last year and is also currently dealing with the Occupy Democracy cases in London. And my defence was one of necessity because of the escalating situation. It was also because, and like, you must have some younger listeners, so I'd like to go into this a little bit because, you see, you and I are of a generation, Tony, where, like, we know about the bombs that were dropped in Japan. We know about the health impacts and the consequences for the people of Japan of those bombs, which are ongoing today, 70 years later. People are still very ill from the bombs that were dropped. I think young people think that nukes are something that happen on a computer game. Do you know, my son plays computer games and, you know, I feel that the young people don't really know what's going on in the world in relation to these weapons. So the defence is, so for example, part of my defence is the fact that there's a convention called the Geneva Convention, and it's been part of international humanitarian law for quite a long time. In the early noughties, it was adopted into domestic law. Because what tends to happen in domestic law when you have a case like this against a nuclear weapon and people have, you know, we're not the first people to take action against Trident. And what tends to happen is people make these arguments about international law and the courts say, well, that's all very nice, but we don't have to do international law here. This is a domestic court dealing with domestic law. And so there's never any movement. In the early noughties, the Geneva Convention was adopted into domestic law. And one of the reasons that the Trident weapon system is illegal under UK domestic law is because of the Geneva Convention. And one of the strands of that is that this weapon, if you release one of those warheads, and that's just one, each submarine carries 48 warheads. Each warhead can deliver, I can't remember how many Hiroshimas, it's something like 100 kilotons. And I can't remember how many Hiroshimas that is, but it's a lot. It's an awful lot. And Hiroshima was one city that was completely flattened by that bomb. So if they released one of those warheads, it would incinerate about 15 million people whilst you and I were having a cup of tea. And so these weapons, when they're used, aren't able to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants. It can't choose between a soldier and a civilian. It can't be targeted in that way. So that's just one strand. There's actually quite a lot more, but that was a strong part of my legal argument. So what happened in court was we were charged with aggravated trespass, and basically it was found that the Crown Prosecution Service had brought a charge that they couldn't prosecute because you can't trespass on a road. Whether that road is public or private, you can't trespass on it. And so we weren't trespassing. And so the charge fell. So unfortunately for us, it meant the judge didn't have to rule on the lawfulness of the work that was going on at Devonport. The judge had a get-out-of-jail-free card, excuse the pun, and was able just to say that we weren't trespassing and the case was dismissed. So where does that leave us? Where does that leave you or I, Tony, as citizens in the UK? I, as a citizen of the UK, am concerned that my government is carrying out preparations constantly for a war crime. It builds, maintains, is talking about extending the life of, renewing Trident when we're committed to disarmament, supposed to be. You know, all of the states in the world that signed up to the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that said, we won't get these weapons if you lot get rid of yours. Well, we haven't got rid of ours, you know, so we're not making the world a safer place. But if I, you know, if my government is committing a war crime, then I can't really take my concern to that government, can I? Even in a democracy. Now, I've done this, Tony. I've been on demonstrations. I've been on marches. I've signed petitions. I've wrote to my MP. I even went last year and went to the police and I reported Trident as a war crime. And they investigated. They never got back to me. It took them a year. And I had to chase them before they got back to me. And then they said, the threshold for a state crime has not been met. Now, I don't know about you. I don't know what the thresholds are for a state crime, you know, when it comes to a police investigation. So I've exhausted all of the democratic means available to me, and I've even, you know, gone to court over this. And I could have been fined a lot of money. I was risking a 3-month custodial sentence. What has a citizen got to do? Because if we can't go to the government, we must have recourse to the courts. If we're going, you know, if our government is making preparation for a war crime, I mean, that just sounds like words, but this is absolutely massive, you know.
So you reckon that you'll be in the court again?
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's not something I did lightly, and it's not something, you know, that I enjoyed doing either, do you know? But I mean, the question I want to ask, you know, your listeners, Tony, is what do we do? What do we do when we know our government is involved in preparing for war crimes? How do we address that? Because it was said after World War II, when the Nuremberg hearings, you know, it was put quite clearly in those Nuremberg trials that citizens have a duty, if they know their state, their government, are committing war crimes, we have a duty to intervene. So what does that intervention look like, and where do we go next? And that's a question that I really wanted to ask on your show and to raise the issue. I mean, one thing I want to say is the people of Britain, there is still time for people to get together and say we don't want Trident. It wasn't just an election issue. We can get together and we can continue to say that we don't want Trident. But, you know, the politicians don't listen too well. So what else do we do?
Well, I can imagine that the courts are probably the best way to get this aired, and it just sounds like a bit of bad luck that you weren't able to with your last case.
Yes, but it's an ongoing thing, because to be able to set any legal precedent, for example, you have to go to Crown Court, which means, like for example, you'd have to commit an awful lot of criminal damage and be risking quite a hefty prison sentence in order to go to court. That's not really the best, you know, as a citizen, why should you have to commit a crime to prevent a greater crime, actually? You know, should you, do you know, and like, what are we doing to the global situation? How are we going, you know, we're undermining whatever peace there is, and there isn't much, but what little there is in the world, we're undermining. Our state is undermining by its position, and it's incumbent on all of us, not just people like me who are, I mean, some might say brave, some might say stupid, but prepared to go to court. You know, it's down to all of us to do something about this. So, I'm not quite sure where next. I think there's going to be a new campaign relating to Trident coming on in the next few months, and maybe I'll get back in touch with you when I've got more of the details, and maybe we can talk about that, because that'll be a bit of the where next thing. But I just really wanted to pose that question about courts, about democracy, about state crime, you know, and what we do. Or do we just all go and watch EastEnders and play with our iPads and forget about it and pretend it's not really happening? I'm not sure that I want to do that.
Okay, Nikki, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you. Cheers, Tony.
That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Ian, who's been living in his car, and also Nikki No Nukes in court for Trident war crimes. Dialect is Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Just contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Oh, it's of a bold captain who sailed the salt seas. How the moon it shone gentle and clear. Oh, I will die, the bold captain did cry. If I can't have that maiden who walks on the shore, if I can't have that maid on the shore. So his sailors all got them a very long boat, and it's off for the shore they did steer. Oh, saying, ma'am, if you please, would you enter on board to view a fine cargo of costly ware, for to view a fine cargo of ware. It was with much persuasion they got her on board. How the moon it shone gentle and clear, oh, and she sat herself down in the stern of the boat, and it's off for the ship those bold sailors did steer, and it's off for the ship they did steer. And when they'd arrived alongside of the ship, oh, the captain he spat out his chew, oh, saying, first you will lie in me arms all this night, and then I'll hand you to me jolly old crew, then I'll hand you right back to me crew. Oh, thank you, this fair maid, she cried, for that's just what I've been awaiting for. I've grown so weary of my maidenhead, as I walked alone on that rocky old shore, as I've walked all alone on the shore. So she sat herself down in the stern of the ship. How the moon it shone gentle and clear, oh, and she sang so sweet, a demon complete. She sung sailors and captain right off to sleep. She sung sailors and captain to sleep. And she's robbed them of silver, and she's robbed them of gold, and she's plundered their bright costly ware, oh, and the captain's bright sword she has took for an oar, and paddled right back to that rocky old shore, and she's paddled right back to the shore. Oh, were me men mad, or were me men drunk, or were they so deep in despair, oh, that they let her away with her beauty so gay? And again she's a maid on that rocky old shore, and again she's a maid on the shore. No, your men were not mad, and your men were not drunk, nor were they so deep in despair. Oh, I deluded your crew, and likewise yourself too. And once more I'm a maid on this rocky old shore, and once more I'm a maid on the shore.